It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the program, we'll look at how Governor Walker's budget proposal fits in with his possible presidential ambitions.
First, as an editorial note, the topic we're about to discuss affects the funding of Wisconsin Public Radio and this program. Governor Walker has proposed significant funding cuts to public media in Wisconsin. His two-year budget announced last week would cut funding from the two organizations that fund Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television.
Those two organizations are the Educational Communications Board, or ECB, and the UW Extension. The cut to the ECB would be about $5 million over the next 2 years, or a third of its state funding. The cut to the UW Extension would be part of the $300 million cut to the whole UW system. The portion of that cut that would affect public broadcasting is not yet known.
Some news reports last week suggested that the budget proposed to eliminate all state funding for public broadcasting. That is not the case. Here with us to talk about the proposed funding cuts are Gene Purcell, Executive Director of the Educational Communications Board. Welcome, Gene.
Hey, Veronica. Hey, Rob.
And Malcolm Brett is with us as well, Director of Broadcasting and Media Innovations at UW Extension. Malcolm, good to have you here.
Good to be here. Thanks.
Well, Gene, we'll start with you. How significant are these cuts to your organization, the Educational Communications Board?
Yeah, and that's a great place to start because, as you point out, some of the very early coverage that we were seeing on Tuesday night and Wednesday referred to things like zeroing out funding or defunding. And that is not the case, but these are significant. So let me put the numbers in some kind of context for you. Right now, at the ECB's budget, about 40% of our budget is GPR, or state support. And so that 40% amounts to about $7.9 million. The governor's proposal would reduce that to $5.2 million. So as you look at the overall state support for the agency, it would drop by about $2.6 million a year.
Okay, and Malcolm, there's a question mark over whether the proposed $300 million cut to the UW system will go through intact at that number. But in the meantime, do you have a sense of how much of that proposed funding cut to the UW system would trickle down to Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television?
We don't. University of Wisconsin system has not allocated portions of that cut to each institution, of which UW College and Extension is where we reside. And there have been no conversations as yet within Extension about how cuts would be distributed within Extension to the various divisions. And so we don't know what the dollar figure would be for Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television on the university side.
You must be busy crunching numbers already, though, to get an idea of what different scenarios that you might potentially be working with. If all of the governor's proposed cuts end up in the final budget intact, what would be the likely total funding cut to WPR and WPT?
I do not know exactly, but if you range up from the annual cut to ECB of $2.5 million, it could easily surpass $3 million with the UW cuts factored in.
And how big a chunk does that represent in the budget?
As I think people know, within the university, the cut to the state funding is 13%. $3 million would cut to Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television would be just under 10% of our annual budget.
Malcolm, lawmakers who support these cuts say that public broadcasting will be able to expand fundraising to cover that shortfall. Do you think that that's right? Is that accurate? Can private donors and grants cover the proposed cuts?
Certainly not in the time frame that's being offered. It's very likely that we will see some spike in giving. Whether that's sustainable over time isn't clear. And certainly a cut of this magnitude would be extraordinarily difficult to replace. We've been assertive, some may even say aggressive, about fundraising for Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television to best serve our audiences. And so there's not a lot of obvious headroom, and I think the notion that that money could be replaced within the biennium is optimistic at best.
Yeah, and one of the things I'd like to add on to that is that we have been aggressive about our fundraising, as Malcolm points out. And so when people think of pledge drives and corporate underwriting, those are most of the things people think about. And in a sense, with public broadcasting, that's kind of the easy money. That's kind of the low-hanging fruit. And as we have gotten better and better and better at doing that type of fundraising, the other opportunities that are left for us, that cost to get into that, those dollars are harder to get. And so we've done a tremendous job, I think. But getting to the next level is going to be a challenge.
Would it require, do you think, a cultural shift in the culture of giving to public broadcasting? Do listeners get used to pledging, for instance, at a certain level? And would this require a step up, Malcolm?
It certainly would require a step up, we hope, from current givers and new givers. I think one of the challenges we face is there has been an historic compact between the state and the donors to collectively support one of the leading public broadcasting organizations in the country. For the state to recede, donors would have to agree, yeah, we're willing to step up and replace that money. It would be a different equation than we have fundraised in the past.
And Gene, like other organizations facing cuts in state funding, you're trying to ensure that these cuts don't end up intact in the final budget. What kind of steps are you taking right now to perhaps lessen the impact?
Well, right now, we are going along with our current budget. We're saving money where we can. And what we're really looking ahead to is what can we do to try to turn these particular proposals around. And so what we're doing right now, you are hearing me now, but people have been hearing me for the past week or so, trying to communicate the message to talk about what I see as being very severe cuts without overstating the message. I mean, I don't want to be, pretending as though the sky is falling, but this is very serious stuff, and it will require some changes in fundraising or something major in terms of service if it goes through as it's proposed right now. So right now, I would say we're kind of the educational mode. We're also working to reach out to listeners, to viewers, to legislators, and just explain the impact that this will have and really where our funding goes to now, because that also is part of a story that people don't always know. What do we do with the state support we get?
I think one of the things we have to really redouble our efforts around is to make sure that people understand we don't feel entitled to this support. We earn it every day. Our staff working in bureaus around the state and here in Madison and traveling the state to serve people around the state, they earn the support through great programming and other essential services. And that's a case that we have to make sure is really well understood at the Capitol.
And Gene, why do you think that the Walker administration is interested at this point in cutting funding to public broadcasting?
Well, all we know is what he has said. And so we have to take him at his word on that. He has said that there are other priorities in state government for funding, and he has listed a variety of those. And so beyond that, I don't want to speculate. But the fact is that it does affect us in a way that it doesn't affect other state agencies. And so one of the things that we want people to know about is that we are and have been over the past several biennia willing to do our share to help the state meet its financial obligations. We have been cut for the last 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 biennia. It goes right on down the line. And we have been treated very much as other state agencies have been treated. And, you know, the cuts hurt, they are painful, and we have dealt with them. A 34% cut to our GPR, our state tax support, is not within that same realm, in my estimation, of being fair.
Malcolm, there may be some perception that public broadcasting is facing these funding cuts right now from a Republican administration because public media is characterized as having a liberal bias. Do you think that is something that could be at play here?
Well, I don't see or hear a liberal bias on public broadcasting in Wisconsin. It's true that people who listen to us come to listen to us with perspectives. And to the degree they hear their perspectives on the air, they're generally satisfied. And when they hear other perspectives, they may be less satisfied. I do not think that the notion of public media being liberal applies here in Wisconsin or really anywhere in the country.
And Gene, let's go to you next. Mm-hmm. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss's spokeswoman told the State Journal that with the mix of all the media options that are available today, the government shouldn't subsidize just one. How would you respond to that?
Well, my response is pretty simple, and it is that public media is more necessary now than ever. And I know that sounds like a cliche, and it sounds like a pledge drive, but let's just think about it. We're on public radio, but let's talk about public television for a moment. You all remember back 15 or 20 years ago when networks like Bravo or Arts and Entertainment or the History Channel were going to come along, and they were going to change the landscape. and public television was going to go away because these folks were going to do history better, they were going to do art better, they were going to do culture better. And let's look at the business models of those stations today, those channels today. You're going to see Pawn Stars. You're going to see Housewives of Orange County. You're going to see channels that have realized that that business model that they were trying to work on doesn't work, and so they have shifted their programming dramatically, leaving public television as the place for art, for culture, for history. And you can make a very similar argument on the public radio side in terms of journalism, in terms of our contributions to art and music and culture. So yes, are there more venues? Absolutely. Is there a need for non-commercial public media? Absolutely. And I would argue now more than ever.
And Malcolm, why should people pay for a service like Wisconsin Public Radio, like Wisconsin Public Television, even if they don't use it? What's the case for that?
Well, in fact, many, many people do use it. Over 500,000 people watch Wisconsin Public Television each week. Nearly 500,000 people listen to Wisconsin Public Radio each week. So a lot of people do use it. As for those who don't use it, I'd say we fortify the civic life of the state. And it's in everyone's interest to have a strong public broadcasting service because we help people become more educated to the issues around them. We help children get ready for school. We teach children in K-12 education. I don't have any children in the school district, but I'm happy to pay my education taxes because this is how we build a stronger society. And so Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television have a role there. And we serve everyone's interests, even those who aren't listening.
We're speaking with Gene Purcell, Executive Director of the Educational Communications Board, and Malcolm Brett, Director of Broadcasting and Media Innovations at UW Extension. They head the organizations that operate Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television. We're talking now about Governor Walker's proposed cuts to public broadcasting in the state.
And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you support or oppose these cuts? Do you have any questions for our guests about them? Assembly Speaker Voss's office has said that the government shouldn't subsidize one particular media outlet. Agree or disagree? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're continuing our conversation about Governor Walker's proposed cuts to public broadcasting in the state. We're speaking with Gene Purcell, Executive Director of the Educational Communications Board, and Malcolm Brett, Director of Broadcasting and Media Innovations at UW Extension. They head the organizations that operate Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television.
And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you support or oppose these cuts and why? And do you have any questions for Malcolm or Gene? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we have a lot of folks that would like to talk with you, but Malcolm, I want to ask you first. A report in the Wisconsin State Journal this weekend suggested that these cuts would likely affect programming on Wisconsin Public Radio and television, not national programming like Morning Edition and All Things Considered so much, but local. Why local?
Well, for a couple of reasons. One is we signed contracts with NPR and PBS to buy a package of programming, so we can't cherry pick. And without the national programming, we wouldn't be serving our audience the way we need to. And frankly, most of our resources are here in the state serving our listeners and viewers with stories about and for the state. And so that's where the investment is. If we were to have to make cutbacks, that's the place where we'd have to go, unfortunately.
Let's get to our callers. John is first in Windsor. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Yeah, you know, I moved up to Hudson, Wisconsin about 24 years ago. And when you live on the Bermuda Triangle of the state of Wisconsin, you get absolutely no Wisconsin news from any media outlet whatsoever because of this thing called the Area of Direct Influence. So anyway, Wisconsin Public Radio finally came to River Falls, and we finally had an outlet where we could finally hear that our governor was not Jesse Ventura, and that really made a huge difference. Mike?
And we're going to just jump in there, John. Thank you so much for that call. I want to make sure we get a response. John, I believe, worried about the coverage to River Falls. He said they finally got WPR up there, and it's made a difference apparently to him. Is that something he should be worried about, Gene?
Well, it is something we hear all the time. I mean, we try to serve the entire state, and in certain parts of Wisconsin, Wisconsin Public Radio, Wisconsin Public Television is the local media. Some years ago, there was a threat to federal funding, and we were talking with Representative Duffy, a member of Congress from in northern Wisconsin, and he actually went across party lines to vote for supporting WPR because he says his constituents support it, and that was good enough for him. So we're hoping to hear more trends like that.
And it's true that where there are larger populations, there's more financial support. And we're really proud of being able to support programming across the state and provide service to listeners across the state.
And we have a lot of bureaus here, at least at Wisconsin Public Radio, including Wausau, La Crosse, Eau Claire. This is a unique reach for the size of the station. Malcolm, are those bureaus on the line? Would you consider eliminating some of the bureaus, one perhaps, if these funding cuts go through intact?
I think it's too early to say we would consider eliminating a bureau. We'll have to look at everything, though.
And as we wrap up, Gene, we spoke with Assembly Speaker Robin Voss last week. He said he expected these cuts to go through, and I believe you said you didn't see why they wouldn't. What do you think is at stake if the cuts go through?
Well, what's at stake is the future of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television as it exists now. You know, we're not going to go away. But if the cuts go through as they are, we can't help but change in some fashion. And so last week, Speaker Voss, the budget was still new, and we hope to have an opportunity to change his mind.
Well, thank you both for joining us. Malcolm, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
And Gene, thanks to you as well.
Oh, you bet. Thank you.
We've been speaking with Gene Purcell, Executive Director of the Educational Communications Board, and Malcolm Brett, Director of Broadcasting and Media Innovations at UW Extension. They head the organizations that operate Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television. We've been talking about Governor Walker's proposed cuts to public broadcasting here in the state. You can continue the conversation on the Central Time Facebook page. With Wisconsin's Comic-Con happening this past weekend in Madison, let's take a closer look at superheroes. They're usually the stuff of fantasy, but that fantasy becomes real in the form of real-life superheroes.
These men and women have normal jobs in the daytime, but at night they wear costumes and take part in special missions. In today's Wisconsin Life, writer T. Krulos introduces us to Wisconsin's superhero culture.
Real-life superhero is someone that adopts their own costume persona in a superhero motif, and they take on a wide range of different missions. Some of them do charity or humanitarian type things, and some of them actually try to fight crime, which is a little bit hair-raising. The first time I read about them was in 2009, and I was like, if there's a local guy here in Milwaukee, I definitely want to meet him. And I found The Watchman, and I set up this late-night meeting with him in a city park. And then I saw him walking through the park in his superhero gear, and I was amazed. I was like, wow, this guy is actually real. He wears a red rubber cowl. He has some red leather gloves. He has a shirt, and he has different shirts depending on the weather. It's kind of a unique Wisconsin concern for superheroes. So he's wearing a thick sweatshirt with his Watchman logo on the chest, and a trench coat and army boots and army pants. And that's his signature Watchman look. Some of them are pretty open about who they are, and some of them are very protective of their identity. And they have a variety of reasons for that. Some of them say they don't want criminals to know their secret identity. And some of them, I think, just are concerned they don't want their coworkers to know that they have this unusual hobby. So real-life superheroes have this term called coming out of the phone booth. And that's when they reveal to other people that they're a real-life superhero, to mixed results. Sometimes it goes well, and sometimes it really doesn't. The Watchman's approach compared to other real-life superheroes I've met is pretty mellow and sensible. He does a patrol, but it's more like a costume neighborhood watch type thing, where he's looking to observe and report more than he's trying to swing in and try to beat up bad guys. He also does a lot of things, like he does an annual Christmas charity where he uses his flashy appearance to kind of draw attention to a toy drive. As time went on, I ended up joining him on patrol several times, and a cool thing was I got to see him inspire other people to join him, and soon he wasn't the only guy here in Milwaukee and was rolling with a team of four or five other guys. The name of the local team is the Challengers, and it also includes Blackbird, Crimson Crusader, Charade, Night Vision, and then Electron actually lives in La Crosse. They go out by themselves or with whoever's available, and sometimes when they can coordinate their schedules, which I found is actually just as difficult for real-life superheroes as it is for normal people, when they can coordinate it, they roll as a team, and it's quite a sight, actually, to see all of them walking down the street together.
T. Krulos is the author of Heroes in the Night, Inside the Real-Life Superhero Movement.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. This episode is produced in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Find more info at wisconsinlife.org.
Coming up after the news, we'll look at how Governor Walker's budget proposal meshes with his possible presidential ambitions. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up later, we'll talk to an advocate for people with disabilities about some of her concerns about the proposals included in Governor Walker's budget.
First, when Governor Walker delivered that state budget address last Tuesday, it wasn't just Wisconsinites who were watching with interest.
As speculation over a Walker presidential run grows, more and more national observers are paying close attention to Walker's proposals, including a $300 million cut to the University of Wisconsin and a $220 million grant for a new stadium for the Milwaukee Bucks. So how do these proposals help or hurt the governor's presidential aspirations?
Joining us now is Leanne Caldwell. She's a political reporter for NBC News. Leanne, welcome to Central Time.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So when you look at this budget proposal and our governor's other activities, looking at Wisconsin from the outside, do you have any doubt that Governor Walker is going to run for president?
I have no doubt that Governor Walker is going to run for president. This is a very political document. It was kind of a Republican-type manifesto that was written to attract conservatives on the national stage. And so it was a very political document, but it also does give some insight into what Scott Walker thinks and how he might govern.
We'll dig into that a little deeper, but more broadly here in Wisconsin, of course, there's a lot of attention to Governor Walker's potential presidential run. Is there that kind of buzz at the national level? Are people really talking about him as a strong contender on the Republican side?
They are. He has done well in recent polls. He topped a poll in Iowa last week. He topped a poll in New Hampshire last week as well. And so right now he's kind of in the Republican front-runner status. Of course, very early on, there's several candidates who are on that same tier with him, including former Florida Governor Jeb Bush. But people are taking a very serious look at Scott Walker. I talked to Republican donors, and many are very intrigued, and some have already said that they're going to get behind him.
So looking at the budget proposal, you said it looks like a Republican manifesto. What are some of the key points in there that you see really appealing to likely caucus voters or early primary voters?
Well, his pledge to end Common Core is definitely one. Another is what's been a conservative talking point of recent that has kind of been revived from a couple decades ago is drug testing of welfare recipients. That was another one. And then, of course, one of the more controversial things are these education budgets the cuts to the University of Wisconsin system that could be seen both ways, actually. It could be politically risky for Walker, but it also could be a boomlet for him in some of these Republican primary districts.
Yeah, I wanted to get into that point. You say that's the one thing that could hang Governor Walker up. Are you thinking that in primary season, that's something that could be a problem for him? Or is this something where, as if he gets through the primary season in a general election, that would be maybe a liability?
It's definitely going to be more of a liability in a general election, but there are some components of the Republican Party who look at this and wonder what he's doing. I talked to a pretty prominent conservative in Iowa who has a radio show and is pretty influential there, and he's more of the ilk that says, look, You're making these cuts to education, but then you're going to give $220 million to the NBA. And he looks at that as just crony capitalism, and it makes no sense. And so he says that's going to be really hard for Walker to attack because, especially, remember, if the Democrats don't have a difficult primary, which it looks like they might not, with Hillary Clinton perhaps jumping in the race, Democrats are going to spend money in the Republican primary as well and try to influence the outcome, and that could very well be an attack. Walker cuts $300 million from the University of Wisconsin system but gives $220 million to the NBA, and that could influence some of these conservative voters as well.
So for the conservative voters, it sounds like you're saying the education cuts in and of themselves might not be the problem. The support for a stadium, the new arena in Milwaukee, that might be.
Yeah, it's about looking at the whole picture. And, you know, sometimes the whole picture gets lost in politics, for sure. It sometimes tapers down to sound bites. But some of these people, some of these conservatives who are politically active, Iowa voters are notorious for knowing the issues very well. And they could look at, this entire budget and say, hey, this doesn't really make sense. Almost half of the budget you're going to make up with cuts to the University of Wisconsin system, and then you're going to just diminish those with giving money to an extremely profitable and wealthy organization such as the NBA.
Now, one of the challenges in a Republican primary is, are you trying to appeal to the more conservative base, likely people to come out in caucus votes and primary votes, or are you going more the mainstream moderate establishment path? Governor Walker, I've seen some analysis that suggests he may have appeal to both sides of that.
That's right. George Will was on a conservative talk show recently, and he said that Walker is the person who can do that, the one that can bridge the Republican Party. And it's really interesting. When I do talk to people in the Republican presidential realm, I always ask, if Walker, is he considered an establishment Republican, or is he considered more of a Tea Party type? And I get both answers, and it's really interesting that he's able to give the persona that he can straddle both realms within the conservative base. And so that is one of the appeals that even the Republican establishment likes about him, the fact that he seems kind of part them, but also can talk in the language and talk to the more Tea Party type.
I could see that as a advantage, obviously, but maybe a liability if I'm a conservative caucus voter. Do I want somebody who isn't straddling that line? I want somebody who's all Tea Party for me, and maybe the same from the other end, from the moderate side. I don't want somebody who might be on the Tea Party side. Are people viewing that as a possible liability, that people might want to go toward somebody closer to their own end of the spectrum?
Well, I haven't heard that so much about Walker because people think Walker is authentic. And that's one of the words that I do get when I talk to people about Scott Walker. They say that there's a level of authenticity there that people really really look to in a potential presidential candidate. And Walker hasn't really – he's kind of – positioned himself nationally as this person who's willing to do what no one else is willing to do. He's willing to take on the unions. He's willing to do what no other conservative or Republican has been able to do as successfully. And he does it more than just with his talk, is what Republicans say. I mean, they look at Chris Christie, the governor of New Jersey, and they say, yeah, part of his MO is to you know, speak the truth and say it how it is and not sugarcoat anything. But with Walker, they say it's not about how he about what he says, but in his actions, and you can look at his budget as one. And so I haven't really heard that criticism about Scott Walker yet. I think that if a Republican, a conservative in the Iowa caucuses is going to want someone who completely believes, you know, exactly is in line with their beliefs, there's a lot of different candidates to choose from in the sense of the Iowa caucus. The voters are usually split between Christian conservatives and social conservatives, and then you have the more economic libertarian conservatives. And so there's going to be a lot of those candidates who will appeal strictly to those bases, but people are saying that Walker is able to appeal to all of them.
Some people have looked at this and said, okay, a Midwestern Republican governor winning in a purple state, a lot of buzz leading into the primaries, and then thinking of Tim Pawlenty of Minnesota, who flamed out very, very early in the primary process last time. Are any Republicans maybe hesitant to step on the Scott Walker bandwagon because of that comparison?
There's been a lot of comparison between Scott Walker and Tim Pawlenty, for sure. But even Pawlenty has come out and said, you know, Scott Walker has what I didn't have, and that is a massive donor base. And, yeah, votes are going to enable you to win a caucus or win a primary, but the donors and the money is what's going to get you into the next contest. And with Scott Walker winning 3 elections in 4 years in a relatively blue state, he has amassed major support nationally from people who are willing to finance his campaign. And that's the difference between Tim Pawlenty and Scott Walker.
So the recall election in particular, where there are a lot of donations, all the limits were off the table there, that enabled him to build up a potential presidential donor list?
Absolutely. And remember that, as you all know very well, that election was not in November with any other elections. It was in the spring or early summer. And so that's what people were paying attention to. It was between major elections, Republican donors who were looking for a cause to support. There was Scott Walker, one who was taking on one of the Republicans' main opponents, is the unions. And so Scott Walker utilized that opportunity extremely well, and it could pay huge dividends for him in 2016.
We're talking with NBC News reporter Leanne Caldwell about Governor Walker's proposed state budget and what it means for his presidential ambitions, and we want to hear from you, too.
Do you think the governor's budget helps or hurts his possible presidential run? Are there proposals in the budget that you think could propel him to the top if he runs, or do you think his plan could cause headaches on the campaign trail? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking with NBC News reporter Leanne Caldwell about Governor Walker's proposed state budget and what it means for his presidential ambitions. You could join in with your questions and your thoughts at 800-642-1234. What signals do you think that budget sends to early primary voters? And hey, if you are one of our listeners in Iowa, do you vote in the primaries, in the Republican primaries in particular? What is your view of Governor Walker as a potential candidate? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Go right to a caller. We've got Marilyn on the line in Janesville. Marilyn, hi.
Hi.
What do you think?
Well, I do like the fact that Governor Walker is able to talk across the party line. That's it.
That's it. Marilyn, thanks for the call. Leanne, so Marilyn perceives Governor Walker, I mean, there's a lot of polarization here in Wisconsin. She perceives him as somebody who could work across party lines. Do you think, as you talk to people about him, is that a view you hear from Republicans or Democrats?
That's not really a view I hear right now. I mean, people are so focused on this, on the Republican primary. Just winning that is going to be a huge feat. And so everyone's kind of focused on what role each of these candidates is going to take within this Republican primary. And the Democrats definitely aren't talking about bipartisanship right now. They are planning to attack Walker, and they're going to attack a lot of these, especially top-tier candidates, as the primary progresses into a general election should Walker win the nomination.
Marilyn, thanks for that call. We'll go to John with us next in Tomahawk. John, hi.
Hello.
What do you think, John?
I'm just kind of wanting to comment on what I believe is Scott Walker's appeal in the state of Wisconsin. I kind of want to prequel this, but I'm not really a fan of Scott Walker, but I kind of see what he's tapped into and where his support has been coming from. And I haven't really heard a lot of comments on it, so I just wanted to make this comment. What I see happening is he's tapping into this very conservative ideal of cutting waste and kind of giving people this hint that they're going to get more back from the state or receive tax cuts or have the government at a state level, at least, and potentially a national level, shrink down and reduce in size and less interference with people's lives. I think that's really what he's tapping into and where he's getting the support.
Gotcha, John. Your line's breaking up there a little bit. I think we get the gist. Leanne, that's kind of the core message that a lot of conservative Republican voters will be looking for. Reduce the size of government and cut taxes.
Yeah, and Scott Walker's budget is proof that that is what he's all about. I was talking to a couple people who watch Republican politics very closely, and they said that this budget does two things. It shows that Scott Walker is dedicated to reducing the size of government, including taxes. I mean, there's the property taxes that are cuts that are proposed in the budget, despite all these other massive cuts and the state budget deficit. But also the other thing is that it also shows that he is going to continue to try to show that he is someone who is bold and willing to take risks, because this budget could be kind of risky for him on a national stage, especially should he win the nomination. And so those two things are really appealing to conservatives.
John, thanks for the call. We'll go to Dennis next in Appleton. Dennis, hi.
Hi. I've supported Governor Walker, but I think he knew exactly what he's doing when he put this budget together. He's going to show the big cuts. He knows they're going to be changed, but he can use that as a platform to say, I've tried to make the cuts, I've tried to reduce government, and it'll play well on a national stage. But I think long-term for Wisconsin, it's not the best thing.
Dennis, thanks for the call. So he's saying the legislature might modify some of these big cuts, but the governor will still have that original document to say, here's what I proposed.
Absolutely. I mean, this is a proposal, right? President Obama unveiled his budget proposal as well, and they both have a long way to go before they're implemented. But yeah, it's a blueprint, and it's a document. It's a document of policy priorities, and he's on the record with these policy priorities, and he's pretty specific with them.
Back to our callers. You've got Chris on the line in Sussex. Chris, hi.
Hi. A couple of points I wanted to make. One of your last callers had said that she felt that Walker could speak across party lines, and I really disagree with that. I think that all of his policies have pretty much been shoved down the throats of people who disagree with him. The second point I'd like to make is I hope that this budget, that people are realizing that this really shows his intention, which I believe is really bolstering the upper class while continuing to take away from, you know, the middle class and people in the lower class.
Chris, thanks for that call. Leanne, in your reporting on this, you talk about some of the potential Democratic lines of attack of a presidential candidate, Scott Walker. Is that one of them, trying to make the case that he supports the upper class at the expense of the middle class?
Absolutely. the Democrat, that's going to be a common theme among that Democrats are going to use among many of these Republican presidential candidates or potential candidates, and Scott Walker won't be immune to them at all, especially with how Scott Walker lately has been talking about the safety net and cuts to entitlements as Medicaid and changes to Social Security and drug testing welfare recipients and or food stamp recipients. And so he is playing into Democratic attacks that are going to be very textbook that do plague many Republicans in how they do talk about especially not even just the middle class but low income people.
Chris, thanks for the call. We've got Elaine with us next in Colfax. Elaine, hi.
Hi. I don't think Governor Walker will hold up to the national spotlight. I think he's very, very divisive. I think he's taken an axe to the state of Wisconsin. He's actually quite reckless. He comes across because he doesn't seem to have a normal conscience. He doesn't seem to be bothered by any way that this has hurt any individual or the institution of great higher learning in the state or the morale of teachers. So I think on closer inspection, when people really look at his record, they'll see him as reckless.
Elaine, thanks a lot for the call. Now, that's what she's saying might speak to a general election, but in a primary, a lot of people are looking for somebody who's going to carry the banner, going to do the things that the core really supports. Do you see that risk of divisiveness or polarization being a drawback for Scott Walker in a presidential campaign?
I'm not sure. In the primary, I'm not sure if primary voters are really looking for someone who can bridge the gap and work across party lines. But Elaine did bring up something really important, and that is the fact now that Walker does kind of have this top-tier status, the vetting on the national stage is going to start very intensely. When you're polling at 2%, the vetting's not going to be as hard. But once you actually have a chance of perhaps clinching, winning this nomination, even though we're, you know, a year out before votes, national reporters, the Democratic Party, there's going to be a lot of opposition research and just research done on Scott Walker and his background and how he governs. And so the vetting is going to get much more intense for Scott Walker than it has been.
In the last Republican primary, all the way through, you had Mitt Romney and the not Mitt Romney kind of flavor of the month thing. Michelle Bachmann, Herman Cain, the list goes out, Rick Santorum. What, at this early stage, does a candidate have to do to not peak and then fizzle and then drop out of the race early?
I know. It is very early, and a lot of these candidates are going to peak. It's a roller coaster ride, and they've entered onto that journey, and Scott Walker is kind of one of the first it candidates. You know, there's Jeb Bush out there, too, who is registering top among the polls. But it's going to be difficult, and they're going to rise and they're going to fall, but what matters is where they are when it matters, and that is when people head to the polls. How are they able to keep up their endurance and use this race as the marathon it is and not the sprint to even just Iowa? Because there's a lot beyond that if they're going to actually win.
Leanne, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed it.
That's Leanne Caldwell. She's a reporter at NBC News.